wanna be free, no.
Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. Today, my guests are Christina Adams and Kim Dower. First up is Christina Adams, and she's in the studio with us today. She's the author of A Real Boy, A True Story of Autism, Early Intervention, and Recovery, published by Berkeley Books just last month, May 2005, and a commentator for National Public Radio's Day to Day. Her work has appeared in the LA Times Magazine, the Los Angeles Times Newspaper, Brain Child Magazine, Alligator Juniper, Kaleidoscope, and Appalachian Heritage, among others. She hosts a show on the Autism One Internet Radio Network. She was born in Washington, D.C., and at 14 with her family moved to an Appalachian farm. She's won awards. She's done this. She's done that. I could go on, but I won't because I want to talk to you. Hi, Christina.
Hello, Barbara.
Oh, gee, I feel like I know so much about this book since I know you, and we've talked about this, and I've heard parts of it long, long ago. Everybody out there hasn't necessarily. So tell us about A Real Boy and how it came about.
Well, since this is a writing show, I have the luxury of talking about the writing, which is a real pleasure. Usually, sometimes I'm asked to talk about autism and all the things you can do to help, which I'm glad to do. But it is nice for me as a writer to talk about this. I suppose my story would be the backstory, so to speak, that I had a career in writing for various entities, government, private industry, things like that. Then got married, had a baby, and got to go to graduate school to get my master's in fiction, creative writing. And right when my son, when I had graduated, I had written a novel, and I was about to venture out into the writing world with my novel. And 5 days before I was about to go to Squaw Valley Community of Writers on a scholarship that I won, my son, we realized that he was autistic. And so I went ahead and went to the writing conference. I came home, and it was all about Autism 101 and recovering my son. So what I did was immerse myself in that world of trying to learn about it and recover him. And at the same time, I began to write about autism, and I wrote a couple pieces, but then this book decided to get born, so to speak.
How did you know there was enough? You know, I mean, it was you were going through it, so there certainly was enough going on with you. But sometimes with ideas, writers don't know if there's enough, if it's an essay, if that suffices, if it's an article. When does it become a book? When did this become a book?
Well, wonderful question. At first, I did write an essay, and that was called I Can't See Anything Else. And it's one of my best things I've ever written because I was in a lot of emotional pain. And for me, that creates good writing.
Yeah.
Not the way you want to do it a lot, but it does have that effect at times. So I did write that. And it did get some attention and things like that. But that just barely scratched the surface. Autism is kind of I think of it as a global prism or lens in which to see the world at sometimes, because It has to do with so much of our modern day world and the way that we think, what the nature of humanity is, and what's going on too out in the larger world. So I guess I didn't really want to write a book about autism, but I had to. And as I started doing it, the trouble was containing it all. Originally, this book turned out to be 400 pages.
Mm-hmm. And what did the manuscript, what did the number of pages end up being?
I think we're at 306 or something like that. Mm-hmm. We did have to chop out about 75 pages.
How did you decide what to chop?
Well, a good editor can really help with that. It was tough because we all were fond of all of it. But I did want it to be a fast-paced read. I wanted there to be a sense of urgency, as there was in my life while I was writing it. It was kind of like a... everything happened very quickly, a full court press on trying to recover him. And at the same time, I was living that story. I was writing it. So I wanted it to have that quickness mm-hmm. to make it a quick read and compel the reader along as best I could.
Mm-hmm. I know there are books out about autism, and they tend to, at least what I see, they tend to be more, self-help, more health oriented. Yours is much more a memoir and very personal. And as I was reading it, I was, and again, because I know you, I was thinking, this sounds just like her. She's writing in her natural voice. This is her on the page.
Well, thank you, I think.
No, it is a compliment. I mean, were you thinking about that you wanted you to be in it, that you wanted it to have a very personal tone, that you wanted your voice to be there and not have it be more of a self-help book that, you know, a lot of self-help books sound rather generic and could be, even though the information might be individual to the author, the writing mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily have a tone or a style.
That was the last thing I wanted to write because it's such an emotional thing when this happens. And because I had been immersed in the world of creative writing, my focus was on being a writer of the best quality that I could do. And also I was a poet before, but I just decided not to get a degree in poetry because, you know, we all know the reasons for that. You couldn't pick a lower paying field. Of course, writing isn't that lucrative either. But so that's what I had been living for a number of years. And before that, I wrote too. So I did not want to write anything like a self-help book. But nonetheless, I knew that I was doing some cutting edge things here. My husband and I were doing some cutting edge things to help. And I knew that other families needed that. Mm-hmm. And so my goal was to write the best quality writing that I could write to keep myself satisfied, but then also to put all the emotional drama that's inevitably goes along with something like this and the reality of it all, mm-hmm. because I knew that we were living a very unusual story, only it's not that unusual anymore because there is an autism epidemic. One out of every 166 U.S. children are now on the autism spectrum. Mm. And they know it's underdiagnosed. It's actually more than that, according to the CDC. But I wanted to put the reality out there, and not only for just people that needed to read the book, but I wanted to create a world that people that are interested in differences or different things
sure.
would like to read. I always liked the psychology section myself. I like mm-hmm. to read about different worlds. And I thought, well, this is the kind of book I would have read, hopefully, even if I wasn't part of it. But then
sure.
I did become part of it.
Sure. Well, read to us.
And
if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and Christina Adams is about to read from A Real Boy, just out by Berkeley.
Like every summer before and since, the waning days of July seemed like a dream to me. The leaves of trees glittered greenly in the breeze. There was a 4th of July celebration, with kids in red T-shirts and shorts showing their brown legs. Stillness hung in the evening air. The afternoon that we left our first preschool for good, I called Jack. He had known only one child with autism when he was in the psychology field, a child who had no speech. And in light of the pediatricians' and therapists' positive past comments, my husband thought there was no chance that the school was right. But when I pumped him for professionals I could consult, he suggested speech therapists. So I got out the local phone book and called every speech therapist and educational expert I could find. By day's end, I'd spoken to 3 speech therapists, an educational consultant, and a person from the special school the preschool director had mentioned. I also called our pediatrician. As I described what the preschool's director and teacher had said about Jonah, each listener was alert and concerned. "Tell me about his language," they all said. "Does he talk?" "Oh, yes," I'd said. I listed some of his recent phrases. "Want to go to the library. Want to go see the water. Want to go see Jordan. Mommy drinks Pepsi. Daddy drinks coffee. Ready for school. Want to see the vacuum cleaner. Want to go home and see Daddy. Say please, see please, say please." No one mentioned the possibility that these were phrases he'd copied, or wondered if he could ask or answer questions. "Oh, he's not autistic," they all said. "Language like that rules out autism." Jonah's pediatrician didn't want to see him, just told me not to worry. At the speech therapist, I booked an appointment with one who had mused that some of Jonah's behaviors, like the way that he could already count things in twos and threes, his ability to notice the tiny details of a flower, and his amazing verbal and oral memory, indicated that he might be gifted. That seemed more likely to me than a learning disorder, considering the bright people who inhabited both sides of his family tree. Perhaps he was both gifted and bothered by something? That was what I was hoping. That was what I could deal with.
Thank you so much. That was Christina Adams reading from A Real Boy, published by Berkeley. The book starts out pretty scary and emotional, and there's some very personal parts about you and your husband dealing with, you know, finding out and what caused it. How was it to write certain scenes in this book and know that at least people that know you and your husband would sort of have, you know, a front row seat to what went on?
Yeah, well, step right up. Well, first of all, that's where a lot of the literary preparation had come in handy, because if you're going to write anything, it's got to have your real personality. It's got to have your real emotional depth in it, or it's going to be dead, lifeless, and boring. And so that I already knew, but graduate school really helped me, get to that message and live it out in what I'd been working on already. And so that I knew that already instinctively. But then when I came into the autism world, I would read some of these books, which you inevitably have to read books when your son gets diagnosed with this or with any major illness. Yes, especially this one, though. And I saw, there's some moms that have written books kind of like this, but the husband's always the shadowy figure in the background, the shadowy, benign figure in the background. And I know there had to be more trauma and drama going on back there, because it's inevitable that it happens. It's just part of the process. Mm-hmm. And so we did have a few clashes early on over some key issues. Fortunately, they resolved themselves with a lot of work, and you know, we're glad to say everything's good. We're still hanging together. But to his credit, he did allow me to write about those things, and he's been very supportive. And I think that's key. It would have been hard to do it without him buying into it.
Sure. Did he read over the manuscript before you sent it off?
He didn't read it before. But then, because it's really nice. I think he trusted me. Mm-hmm. Never trust a writer. Never. Let me tell you that.
Always sell on somebody else.
But he did. And so at the very end, I said, okay, this is your chance. Read it now. And I did, you know, it's nice then when you can see that somebody else has a memory of something and you have a memory of something and you put it together, then you can see, yeah, I can see how your memory is different than mine. But nonetheless, it didn't change the facts. It was nice to see that. But he made just a couple of changes, not many at all. Not many at all.
Something that comes up a lot, at least with students, is writing about personal stuff and worrying about what people are going to think or feel, and trying to protect them, you know. And sometimes you need to write about what you need to write about that's personal, and at the same time find ways to protect the people that you're writing about.
Well, I think it's very important. I'm not going to sit here and say that you don't have to worry about those things because you do. But there is a point to worry about them, and it's usually not during the writing process.
Right.
You will have plenty of time later to adjust and rewrite. And it's funny because you can never tell what people are going to object to and what they're not. A lot of people will object to the very tiny little thing that you think is inconsequential, but to them it's a very big deal. And then other things they have no problem with. Mm-hmm. And as many times as I've tried to predict what it will be, I've been wrong every time. And now when we're talking about that topic, there are some ethical issues that come up, of course, and they should be there, and you have to be careful with those. But I wanted to make sure that because I was writing about a child, and he was my child, and so I had to protect him. But I also wanted to record this story for him, for myself, and for other people.
Sure.
And so I chose not to put his picture on the cover, even though the publisher wanted to do so, and they respected it when I said no. I chose a lot of things to kind of not, to give him some privacy because he's doing so well. But even if he wasn't, I feel like that should be his choice when he's old enough. And of course, now he's very mad at me. Why am I not on the cover? I want, don't you get money for this? And I said, why are you asking this? And he said, because I want the money and the attention and I should be on the cover. So he's, it's pretty funny. You never know what they're going to think either.
Right.
So now he says that I should make a website and, you know, he's got all kinds of creative ideas for marketing.
Right. Well, you do have a website.
Yes, I do.
Do you want to give the address?
Yes. It's, ChristinaAdamsWriter.com. That's Christina with the CH, Christina Adams, and then writer.com. And please visit me. It's got my appearances on there. And if you're anywhere near me, come by and let's talk.
Yeah. Again, you're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm with Christina Adams, author of A Real Boy, published by Berkeley, just out last month. I can't believe we're in June. This is too much. Too much for me to handle it right now. You were working on a novel when this book descended on you. What happened?
Good thing to put it. Everybody asked me that because I was really, really, I loved my novel. I enjoyed it. It was so much fun. You have to live a novel while you're writing it. And I had been living in that novel for 2 years. And but when this all happened, it pretty much poleaxed the past. And now people that remember that novel, because it did win an award at school and some things like that, they always say, well, what about that? What about that? And I think its time has come and gone, and I'm just not emotionally connected to that anymore.
Sure.
Nonetheless, though, I do want to write a novel again, and I hope that I will.
But don't you think, because, again, this comes up a lot with new writers, where you put years, pages, hundreds of pages into a project, and either it doesn't sell or you get sidetracked and you try to go back to it and it's gone. And rather than thinking that's a waste of time and energy, it got you to where you are. I mean, don't you think it, you know, whatever you're writing, whether it's published or not, it's, if you're working hard, most likely after it, you're a better writer.
Barbara, I've written so much because when I write big. My novel was also 400 pages. And I have written so many short stories and essays and all kinds of things. And of course, most of them haven't been published somehow, but who has the time to go back and try to get all those things published?
Sure.
But on the other hand, I'm everything you write makes you better. And there are things about that novel that, like most first novels, should stay in a drawer.
Right.
There's some really good stuff in it, I think. But on the other hand, there's things I think, ooh, that is so amateurish. No, no, no. But it all makes you better.
Yeah.
And for writers out there, I will say that, I mean, things that I did, writing all kinds of copy, writing Defense Department, you know, things.
That's right. You were an editor at the Pentagon.
Yes, I was. And I also wrote speeches for generals and wrote copy for the B-2 and all kinds of things. I've written just about everything. And all of that made me a good writer, too. Mm-hmm. So never put down what you're actually working on. I mean, as far as thinking it's not valuable, because it is.
Yeah, well, that comes up so much. You know, it's like, I put a year into this. What if nothing happens? Yeah, that's a possibility.
Yeah, it is.
It's a good possibility.
And that's also interesting because the story on this book was, it was not the easiest book in the world to get out there.
Mm-hmm.
I had the wonderful experience of going to Breadloaf, the famous old writers' conference
in Vermont.
And I enjoyed that very much. And it was incredible to be around so many talented people. Those were some very talented people at all levels. But when I told people what I was working on, the agents and editors, it was as if I had showed them a large, you know, odoriferous fish from 3 days ago. Because apparently there was a category that I knew nothing about called disabled child memoirs. I had no idea that that's what I was actually writing. And so, you know, like they say, most of them were parents and they're written pretty badly.
Right.
So I think they didn't see my work. They just kind of assumed I was
what it was
going to be, you know, in doing that. But I kept saying, no, really, I am a writer, really. And so fortunately, I did find a wonderful agent, and Marcy Posner, she's been on your show, I believe. Mm-hmm. And then we found a good editor. But I will tell you that it took me 6 months to find an agent. And it, you know, then after that, we were able to sell it. But you've got to keep going. Got to keep going.
Well, when you were at Breadloaf and you were getting this sort of reaction, how did that affect you and how did it affect your writing?
Well, it was good. And there were some high points and low points. Everybody in the workshop really liked my work. And the one thing that cheered me was there was a writer from the New Yorker magazine there. And she came to the workshop because she had picked my first chapter out of all the chapters mm-hmm. on the shelves. And she mm-hmm. came to hear me. Hear it to get discussed at the workshop. So that made me feel really good.
Yeah.
And so that was my one little hope spot when all the other people were saying, well, this is very therapeutic for you, but, you know, good luck.
Right.
So it really did crush me for a while, though, and I don't crush easily, mm-hmm. As people that read the book will probably know.
Right.
But I did stop writing for about 3 or 4 months. It did kind of take the wind out of my sails. And then I determined, I'm going to get this book out there no matter what.
Right.
No matter if I have to do anything.
Mm.
So
it seems to be what it takes much of the time.
It really does.
It's that sort of perseverance and not letting up.
Mm-hmm. It does. But I will say now that I've been through the publishing mill, it is, you've got to ask who's going to buy this book. You mm-hmm. have to have a market. You have to have somebody that's going to buy your book. And if it's a good book, that's essential, but that's sometimes not even enough.
Right.
You've got to promote. You've got to get someone to buy this book.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is on you and not your publisher.
Right. Which is discouraging to certain writers that they have to market.
It's kind of sad that you work so hard to be a good writer, but you're still expected to multitask with all these mm-hmm. things. And I'm lucky that I did have a background in public relations and in marketing and mm-hmm. things like that. So that has helped me quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I also speak. Being able to speak at conferences and things also helps writers a great deal. So all of your other skills, if you have any, gather them up no matter what they are.
Mm-hmm.
Computer, that's very important too, internet
that's
marketing.
Right. Mm-hmm. You are still listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Christina Adams for a few more minutes. She's author of A Real Boy, published by Berkeley. I want to talk about the book specifically, some of the material in it for a minute. And one thing that really struck me was how working with diet really seemed to make a difference with your son.
Mm-hmm. When I say that autism is a lens to which view the modern world, I'm serious because diet is an issue. The chemicals in the modern day environment are an issue. Medical healthcare issues do apply. Education system, it has everything to do with the state of the planet, so to speak. And it turns out that who would have thought that taking cheese and butter out of a child's diet can make their autism significantly diminish? So that begs the question, what is autism? Everybody thinks it's just kind of this strange psychological thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've come to see that it's not it at all. It's a combination of intelligent people with sometimes immune system weaknesses or interesting things like that medically in their background that may look like asthma, allergies, whatever. And sometimes you'll take that population and they get a few environmental assaults, be it from pollution, diet, antibiotics, chemicals, drugs, things like that. And boom, suddenly your child's autistic.
Mm-hmm.
And so my son has to still be on his diet.
Mm-hmm.
And he can tell me now, like he'll say, you know, my brain's itching. It feels like there's something in there and I want to take mm-hmm. it out and kick it to the curb.
Interesting.
And he said that when he was six. He's seven now. But he knows what he can have and how it affects him. And now he's able to feel it and to say.
Mm-hmm.
And so he manages it on his own diet.
Mm-hmm.
It's astounding. You would not believe it unless you've seen it like I have. It's hard to believe, but I know it because I live it. I've talked to thousands of people now and seen their children, and I do mentor people at times. And I say, take this away, take this away, take this mm-hmm. away. And boom, sometimes it's mm-hmm. night and day difference in the kids.
Yeah. And even adults, I mean, we get so stuck in certain things we need to eat or want to eat, and it causes all kinds of horrible health problems, but we don't, you know, we don't connect it. Instead of dealing with the food, we go to the drugstore mm-hmm. and get something to treat the symptoms so we can still do the food.
Yeah. It's fascinating because, you know, I had a mother that was very good because she never believed in a lot of junk food and things like that. But parents today don't really have the time to think about that, to cook like they used to. And we're bombarded with, why can't we have the meat lover's pizza from Pizza Hut or whatever the latest right. food trend is? It seems normal to us to eat like that. Mm-hmm. But really, it isn't, and it's having a bad effect on a lot of things. Who knows why diet manifests in autism, but it's complicated. It's an immune system issue, and that's only one of the issues, but it's a very important one.
Mm. Oh, and we're at the end of our time. Getting back to writers, do you have any advice for the writers listening?
Read and go into your own mind and find the wonderful things that are in there and pull them out. And that's what's going to give your best work. Mm. That's what's going to get you your best work to give to the rest of us.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you so much.
Thanks to you, Barbara. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Writers on Writing, and that was Christina Adams, author of A Real Boy, published by Berkeley, just out. Check out this book. And, of course, I always harp on the covers, and it has a wonderful cover, even though your son isn't on it. It's great. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute with Kim Dower. Don't go away.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. One belt in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Going to rise up singing.
shake the sky. But till that morning, never nothing can harm you. With Daddy and Mammy standing by.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we are about to bring Kim Dower on the line. Kim is known throughout the publishing world and publicity world as Kim from L.A. It's the name of the company she founded in 1985. In addition to her work as a literary publicist, Kim specializes in media training and coaching authors, speakers, and experts of all kinds on how to best present themselves to the media. She's been on before, and I'm happy to have her on again. Hi, Kim.
Hey, Barbara, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, I'm fine.
Well, it's funny, Christina Adams, who was on during the first half of the show, reminded me of you because her training was as a poet as well, and you started out as a poet.
Yeah, well, yes, I started out, and I'll probably go out as one, too.
Well, so what happened? What happened with poetry?
Oh, my goodness. What happened? It's too lonely and depressing. You know, you don't get to talk to anyone. You have to, you know, want to kill yourself all the time. No, I mean, seriously, I think that, well, first of all, it's very hard to earn a living as a poet. It's hard to earn a living as a writer, but a poet, it's the hardest, probably, unless you're going to teach. And I think that I just ended up pursuing other things and started working for a publisher. And really loved that and loved making phone calls all day and talking people into talking to authors. And it sort of took with me, and I became a publicist.
And you are a wonderful publicist.
Thank you.
You're so energetic and positive.
It's just... Yeah, I know. See, how could I be a poet? And I shouldn't say that. There's a lot of energetic, positive poets out there, so I don't mean to be silly. But I think that, you know, being social and liking to talk, and it's hard to sit in front of a, you know, a computer and write all day. So I do prefer the more social aspect of publicity.
Sure. Tell me what happens when somebody comes to you. Someone has a book coming out, or perhaps they already have a book coming out. How do you, or has already come out, how do you start with them?
Well, the first thing, and I'll just say before I answer that question, that more and more it's important for authors and writers to do this, because books, you know, I just got back from Book Expo, which is the big convention in New York that, you know, has all the, you know, hundreds of authors and publishers there with booths showing what's coming out in the fall. And the word around the convention from booksellers was that writers these days, it's more about entertainment than it is about books, unfortunately. When an author goes out on a book tour, it's not enough to just simply do a reading, answer some questions, but one has to be more entertaining and know how to handle an audience and know how to deal with questions. And so more and more authors are coming for the media training or the coaching or whatever we call it, because it's very hard to make the shift from being in a room for years sometimes, not talking to anyone, just writing, and suddenly your book comes out, you're thrown out on this book tour, and you have to socialize, and you have to answer questions articulately, and you have to be involved with people, and it's a big transition for a writer to have to do that. And as we say in my company, there's a big difference between a good book and a good guest on a talk show or in a reading. And, you know, I'm sorry to say this, but we've all been to readings where you just cringe. You know, why are they going on so long? Why did they pick that passage? You know, they don't know how to handle an audience. I mean, it's hard to get up there and perform when you're a writer, not a performer.
Yes.
So we are getting more people coming to just basically learn what they need to do when they go out. So in answer to your question, what do we do when they come here? It's the first thing, well, we read the book to obviously see what the book is about and learn how to help bring out the strong parts of the book or the interesting things that they might discuss. And then we sit down with them and we say, I mean, I say, why are you doing this? Why are you going on a book tour? Because the number one thing that we need to ask ourselves before we're about to do something is, why are we doing it? And then we can plan how to do it best.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the most fascinating part, that first hour where you start to, it's like peeling an onion, where someone gets closer and closer to really why they're going out on the book tour.
Yes. Do most authors come to you before their book has come out, or do you have authors come to you afterward?
Well, it's really important to come before, because usually 6 weeks before the pub date is when you start to think about how are you going to present yourself, how are you going to talk about your material, your schedule is coming into place from your publisher, and you need to start sort of imagining what it's going to be like when you're in front of the camera and start to really focus. And so we work with these people sometimes, you know, 6 weeks before, sometimes longer, and then again sometimes maybe 2 weeks before they go on the road to do like a little refresher course.
And what if there's a question before this next question, and that is that you don't always know what your publisher is going to do for you before your book comes out. And why aren't publishers better at this, at telling you exactly what's going to go on so that you have really time to hire somebody or even to suggest that you hire somebody?
Well, it's a good question, and it's very frustrating. I mean, the publishing business can be, for some people, it's a wonderful experience. They love their publisher. Their publicists in-house do everything they can to make it a great experience. And then sometimes you sort of get dumped, basically, and you're in the dark and no one tells you anything. I think that for all writers listening, to all authors with books under contract, one needs to know the publishing process. We need to understand the timing involved, when things are going to happen. The more we understand about publishing, the more able we are to help ourselves get what we need. So publishers are not very forthcoming all the time. If you are one of their big titles, it's a blockbuster, they're putting a lot of money into marketing, they'll tell you, we're going to send you to 5 cities, we're going to do advertising, this is what you need to know. But most people are what we call mid-level, mid-list authors, and they don't get that kind of treatment. So at an appropriate time, which is usually 4-5 months before your book is going to come out, right? Mm-hmm. So if your book is scheduled for November, you know, now would be the time that you would speak to your publisher, you would talk to your editor for starters, because that's the person you have a relationship with, and you'd say, I'm ready to talk to the publicity department. And when you get that person there, just ask some questions. You know, are you guys planning to send me on a tour? Is there any money in the budget? Should I think about hiring my own person? And I tell writers that they should become partners with their publishers. It's not that I wrote the book, my work is done, let them do the rest, because that's just not a realistic situation anymore. So you need to get involved, find out what they're doing, find out how you can supplement their efforts, and if you have any money you can spend on an outside publicist, you should do that.
Hmm. What does it take? I mean, what's a reasonable, you know, budget to put aside for a publicist when your book comes out?
Well, I don't want to scare your listeners. I think that there's different amounts of money will do different things. I think that you need at least $5,000 to get the ball rolling with anybody who's good in one or two markets or cities to help you with things. A wonderful writer and a wonderful person, Carolyn C., taught me a long time ago. I heard her speak at a class years ago. And she said, you know, for writers, the minute you sign a contract with a publisher, the minute it's real, you should open a savings account as if you were having a baby.
Yes.
And you should save every month for that baby. And when your book is born, you have some money to spend on a publicist.
Mm-hmm.
You really need to think of this more as a business. And there are some people who are wonderful self-promoters who can do it themselves, who get in a car and throw their books in the back and travel around and meet booksellers. And you can do it that way, too. You know, there are books you can buy that help you understand this process. But I think for starters, $5,000 will get you someplace.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with Kim Dower. Her business in L.A. is Kim from L.A., and that's her website, too, kimfromla.com. She's a literary publicist who has been in business since 85, yeah?
It's a long time.
Long time.
20 years.
Do you have clients all over the place, or are they mostly in California?
They are all over the place. They're everywhere. I can't even remember, but, you know, It's many years. I've worked for a lot of different publishers, and a lot of authors have hired me. So I run into people at functions, and I know, weren't you a client of mine? Like 15, you know.
Sure.
So, I've had a great, just a wonderful group of people I've worked with over the years. And I do learn a lot from them. You know, I had a book come out a year ago called Life is a Series of Presentations.
Yes.
And I went on my own book tour, and I think I've told you this before, but it's startling to do it. Even when you teach people how to do it, it's not until you get out there yourself that you realize how difficult it is.
Mm.
You know, you do a couple of radio shows, a television show, a book signing, and by the end of the night you're exhausted and you have to wake up in the morning and start all over again. And you have to sound fresh and entertaining and like you've had a good night's sleep.
Yes. Well, you know, speaking of your own book, then, how long do you promote your book? I mean, are you promoting your book, in the course of a day? Or do you, you say, okay, I'm going to do one event a month because I have this other stuff I'm doing, too. You know, how do you keep it going and how long should you keep it going?
Well, if you're a fiction writer, there is sort of a time limit because after 3 or 4 months, the hardcover book is off the shelf, sadly, in many cases. And then if they publish you in paperback, you've got that chance again the next year. But fiction is different from nonfiction. Nonfiction, as you know with your own wonderful book, it's something that's part of who you are then. It's what we call a perennial. It can last forever. The information in the book is always going to be good, always going to be valid, and you can use that book to just integrate into what you do. If you give talks about speaking, you can continue to promote your book. So, you know, my hardcover was published 2 years ago. The paperback came out in February. So it's 4 months later, and I still, whenever I have a chance, I'll talk about it. I'll, you know, sell it at different functions and speaking engagements I do because it's still a valid book.
Yes.
And it also, you know, it helps with my talks. And after I give a talk, it's very good for people to have it because they can continue to learn what I'm talking about with the book.
Yes. Well, I recall you came on the show when the book came out. And so when I started my promotion back in the fall, I took out Life is a Series of Presentations.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, I'm going to be out there now. And it was really helpful.
Good.
Really helpful. You know, speaking, because I think speaking and presenting yourself is, the number one fear besides death or something?
Well,
like that?
It is the number one fear. And there are people who are just good at it. They're born speakers. They can get up in front of a group. They love it. And that's wonderful. But for most of us, it's a learned skill. We don't suddenly know how to get up in front of a group of people. And I know some wonderful, hardworking, intelligent, very successful people who, if they have to get up in front of a group, their heart is pounding so hard and they get pale and shaky and they just can't do it. But they can learn how to do it. So, and I think for many authors, particularly novelists who are in many cases shy and introverted, it's terrifying for them to have to get up in a bookstore and do a talk.
Yes.
I mean, they would rather be dead at that moment.
Right.
But I tell you this, I've never met one who, after practicing, either working with me or just going out on their own, after a month of doing it, doesn't become a ham. And then you can't usually shut these people up. You know, I mean, that's the truth.
That's so true.
People, once you get the hang of it, it's a wonderful thing, and people really enjoy doing it.
Hmm. Well, let's get back to the authors who are already published, say have had their book come out, large publisher, medium-sized publisher, whatever, and then they find out that the publicist isn't able to get much coverage, even though perhaps they're trying. At what point do you consider going to an independent publicist? At what point should, and is it too late then, or is there still stuff that can be done?
Well, I was going to say it's sort of a catch-22 because it can get too late. And I have a lot of people call me very upset. The book's been out a month, no publicity was done, and they're literally frantic. You know, can you help me? Is there anything you can do? And it's very hard for me. It's sort of like, I don't know if this is a good analogy, but, you know, if someone calls a lawyer after they're already going to trial and, you know, can you help me better than the lawyer I have?
Right. Now, is it the same for fiction and nonfiction, or is it kind of different?
It's basically the same. I mean, the best case scenario is a publicist wants 4 to 6 months before the book comes out. We want to read it. We want to understand it. We want to get to know you, the author. And then we start to formulate what's available, what's possible, what do we think we can do. A lot of this planning goes on in our heads. We make lists. We have wish lists. We discuss it. And we start to sort of piece together what's possible. You know, then the next stage is about 2 months before the book is actually on the shelf. The book is available. We do mailings, and we start to make phone calls. And we want, you know, the signings in place, whatever media we can get, we want it all in place so that when the pub date comes, it's ready to go. Now, if your book comes out and you think your publisher is doing whatever they can, you're a month into it, and you find out nothing's going on and the publisher doesn't have anything, and you come to an outside publicist, we don't really know what has been done. We don't know how to pick up the pieces. Usually we're busy with other projects. But if you do find us with some available time, it's still difficult to see how do we jump in. I always want to know, well, what's already been done? Because you don't want to call places that have already been called.
Right.
So it's very difficult. And it's the worst thing for an author to be in that situation. So you want to talk to your publicist in-house and find out what they're doing. At the same time, you don't want to bug them and make them feel pressured all the time. So it's a hard balance here.
Mm-hmm.
But you do need to check up a couple of months before and say, what are you planning? do you think I should spend some of my own money and hire out, or tell me your plans, how can I help? And then, unfortunately, you just never know if they tried and didn't get it, or if they didn't try at all.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would imagine that in terms of publicizing a book, it's sort of a mix of things that help get the word out. Reviews, appearances, a little of this, a little of that. Is
yes.
that the case, or is it, you know, are you always trying for the reviews more than you're trying for anything else?
Well,
book reviews, reviews on prominent websites.
Reviews are key. You know, obviously, there's nothing better than a review in the New York Times to sell your book, if it's a good review. A lot of times we really work hard to get reviews in these places, and the review comes out, it's not so good. And then we think, well, why did we work so hard for that?
Yeah.
But reviews are very important. As you say, it is a mix. Hopefully that mix is all occurring at the same time, so that the review, the ad, the radio show, the TV appearance, the bookstore appearance all come out around the same time, so that you'll be hitting different people in from different directions.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of an orchestrated affair, so that, you know, people who listen to radio don't necessarily watch TV, etc.
Right.
And you'd like that to happen at once.
Mm-hmm. We have, are you going to go on?
I just want to say that,
yeah, sure.
You know, one of the great ways, you know, authors can do a lot more than they actually think they can. But for local authors, for those of us in Southern California, if you, for example, have a book signing at a store and send out invitations to 100 people and get all your friends, everyone you know there to buy the book, that's a good way to launch the book right then and there.
Yes.
If you sell 50 or 60 copies that night, the book has a nice start. And again, you know, web pages are important, sometimes more than other times, but for nonfiction authors to incorporate their book into their talks, to do schedule yourself at talks around the country, and then you can sell the book there. These are all really good ways to get the word out.
Yes. Well, for first-time authors, and everybody, you know, whenever you have a book come out, everybody's always like, well, you just have to get on Oprah. Well, unfortunately, most people don't get on Oprah, and unless it's the book club, I've heard you don't necessarily sell a ton of books either.
Right.
So what types of shows do you try to place first-time authors on? Or are there, I mean, do you go, well, a first-time author is going to have more experience or be more comfortable on radio, so let's do that? Or do you say, listen, you just need some, you know, local TV to start, and then we'll go a little bigger, a little bigger? I mean, how do you work all that? And how do you figure it out whether somebody is telegenic? Does that matter? All of that.
Well, it all matters, and everybody is a different. Everyone has a different case. So, first of all, what is the publisher doing to back this book up? If this is a first novelist and they're publishing 5,000 copies and they're not distributing it widely across the country, it's not going to really help at that point to do a national show. So you need to have the books out in numbers. And there are some people who are much better on camera than others. You want to look at who you are as an author and what you have to bring to the table. So if you were to come here, for example, one thing that we might do, if you're particularly good on camera and if your book has national potential, that is, if the publisher thinks and if the marketing people are backing this and getting a lot of books out and getting them on the tables at Barnes & Noble, et cetera, we might do a tape of you doing an interview and do that 3 months early so that your publicist can send it out to some of the national shows and entice them with this tape.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, definitely for first-time authors, we like to start them off on smaller shows and get a show in a smaller market and have a tape of that, because you can't get on any national television show anymore at all without the producer seeing tape of you.
Mm-hmm.
That's just out of the question.
Right.
And it's for an obvious reason. You're not going to have someone on your show whom you haven't seen on camera. Can they speak? What do they do with their hands? How do they come across? This is all really important.
Mm-hmm.
So we do these sort of fake tapes to send out to the major shows. And again, what you do to promote the book really depends a lot on what your publisher is going to do, how many books they're getting out, what's in the budget, how much do you have to promote the book, and how promotable are you?
There's a lot to consider.
There's a lot to consider. And it is daunting. I mean, unfortunately, it used to be the hard part was writing the book, and now there's two hard parts, you know, writing it and then selling it and promoting it.
Yes.
And getting people interested. But for everyone out there, I mean, the energy and the enthusiasm has to, it begins with you, it ends with you. The minute you stop caring is the minute everyone's going to stop caring.
Yeah.
And there are ways that you can keep it alive and keep it going. And sometimes you have to move on to the next thing if it didn't work. But you need to give it your best shot. And the number one way to do that is to understand the publishing business. Understand how it works and what you can bring to the party and what you need to bring to the party.
Yes. Oh, Kim, I'm going to have you on again because
we
have more to talk about. So if people want to get in touch with you, go to your website, kimfromla.com, and there's a little button that says contact, and you can email Kim. And
And can we say that
sure.
I'm doing this talk for California Writers Association on Saturday, June 18th.
This coming Saturday.
In Fountain Valley.
In Fountain Valley, in Orange County. Do you want to give the website of the group or a contact something or other?
I think all you do is ocwriter.com.
Yes, and there you'll find info.
Yeah, and that would be a good, I don't know what they charge. I don't think it's expensive, but I'm going to do a two-hour talk.
I think it's maybe $20. I mean, it's
okay,
so cheap.
Okay, and you get lunch.
You get lunch.
See?
It's a good lunch.
It's a good lunch, and I'll talk for an hour before lunch and an hour after lunch, and it's right in your neck of the woods. I have no idea where Fountain Valley is, Barbara.
Just down the 405. Take, I don't know.
I'll figure it out somewhere. It's the OC.
That's right. It's
all
down
right.
This way. Thank you so much.
Thank
for
you.
For coming on the show, Kim.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
That was Kim Dower. She's author of Life is a Series of Presentations, along with Tony Jerry. And again, she'll be at the Southern California Writers Association this Saturday. Probably starts around 9 or 10. Go to ocwriter.com or go to her website, again, kimfromla.com, and find out more. You can also go to my website, penonfire.com. To find out about people coming on the show, to find out about my book called Pen on Fire that is fortunately still in bookstores selling, and to find out whatever you need to find out. There's a blog you can connect with, and that's fun. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Ernest Hemingway to John Dos Passos in 1932. He said, "Remember to get the weather in your damn book. Weather is very important." It's true. Very. Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.